does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
I will be honest with you, it feels almost unnecessary to have an introduction for our next guest. He is a basketball icon in the state of Indiana, and you will never meet, and I can tell you that as sure as today is Thursday, you will never meet anybody who saw him play that will tell you anything other than Rick Mount is the greatest shooter they have ever seen in the game of basketball. He was, of course, on the 1969 Purdue team that made the Final Four. They got all the way into, in the Final Four, the national championship game before dropping to UCLA. But Rick Mount joins us on the program now. Rick, it is a true pleasure. How are you?
Okay, Jake. How you doing?
You know what? I'm excited for Purdue. I'm excited for their fans and, you know, just this run. Excited to talk to you as well. So let's begin with this. I mean, you are, you know, one of the, if not the all-time great at Purdue, and now you get a chance to see your alma mater in the Final Four. First off, just your reaction about where they are now and your thoughts on the job Matt Painter's done.
Oh, Matt's a great coach, and he's done a great job bringing these guys to where they are right now. And the team is playing well. I think they got their first five, and they got Gillis, and they got Heidi, and they got Coleman at the other three spots. They got eight guys that can play and get it done. So I think they're going to be okay.
When you look back, Rick, on your time playing for Purdue, and you know, I had read, and I don't know if this is true or not, that you ended up at Purdue, obviously close to home, right there near Lebanon. I thought I read somewhere that maybe Miami was another school where you were thinking about going, but obviously it worked out for you at Purdue. What are your overall memories, I guess, and just your sentiments in general of being a Boilermaker?
Well, you know, it was the fan. I remember Red Mackey. I went in and had a meeting with him on my visit, and he was the athletic director. He's the one that started all this Mackey Arena. And it was the offices were there, but it was just a big hole, you know. And so he says, this is my dream, Rick, and we want you to be part of it. And it turned out to be that I was part of it. And we got it going. We had the dedication game with UCLA, and we almost beat them. And there was, like, I always remember this, Bob King was an assistant coach at Purdue, and he was downstairs on the floor. He told me this story, talking with a guy, and the guy says, I don't know if they're going to let you play, Bob, because you probably got 16,000-17,000 in there and only held 14,123. And he says, the fire marshal might shut this game down. He said, bull crap, he's sitting right over there on the front row. So they wasn't going to shut the game down. He had front row tickets, and the fans, that's when it all started with the fans and crazy, and teams hated to come to Purdue to play because of the fans, and they were great.
Rick, what do you remember most about that run by you and the Boilermakers in 69?
Well, see, back then you only played 32 games instead of 68 now or something like that. And we started out in the Mideast Regional in Wisconsin, and we played Miami, Ohio, and Kentucky played Marquette. And we won, and Marquette beat up on Kentucky pretty good, but that's where it started, right there, and I always remember this. you know, you need a little luck once in a while to get that far to the final game. You got to have a little luck, too. So we're playing Marquette with Al McGuire. And Al McGuire was a fiery guy. He was really fiery. And he came by George King at the half. We had him down a little bit. And I'm getting some rosin on my hand. And he turns and gets right in George King's face and says, "Now we're going to kick your ass." And George says, "You couldn't do it in the NBA. You're not going to be able to do it now." So the game was right down to the wire. It's tied up with 25 seconds to go. And Dean Memminger, you heard of that name.
Yep.
And he's got the ball. He's out there, and he's they're going to hold it for one. They ain't going to give us another. They're not going to give us a shot at it. They're going to take a shot, and if it goes in, they win. Or it goes in overtime. So he shoots one from about 16 feet, comes off the rim, and that big George Faber, the Faber B. Winda, that guy made millions of dollars on that. The guy's starting to put it up with 2 seconds to go, and Faber just grabbed him. This guy's got two shots, and I always remember this. And if he makes one of them, we lose and we go home. Right before he got the ball, the referee gave him the ball. I'm in the blockout lane. He turns to me and he says, "It's over." He's telling me it's over. So I didn't say anything to him because I wanted him to keep concentrating on what he just said to me, you know. So he puts the first shot up and it hits the neck of the rim, comes off. Now I'm looking at him. I'm not saying anything to him. He won't look at me now. And the second free throw he put up was an air ball. So the game goes in overtime. And I hit that last second shot in overtime to put us in the final four. But, you know, things like that, all you had to do is hit one shot, one free throw, and they beat us, but they didn't.
So, Rick, let me tell you the story George Faber told me years ago.
And he lies a lot. Just remember, he lies a lot.
That's the best part about George Faber, right? You know what I mean? His windows, his windows are a lot more clear and easy to see through than his stories, right? So, So Rick, Faber tells me that in that Marquette game at Wisconsin Fieldhouse, you're in overtime, you're getting ready to, your George King calls a timeout, you're in the huddle, and Faber admits to me, he says, "Jake, we're walking out of that huddle and I can barely walk straight because my knees are knocking because I'm so nervous because there's just the tension and the moment." And he said, "I feel this tug at my jersey," and I turn around, and it's Mount, and Mount says something to me. Now, I guess I'll put you on the spot. No, I take that back. I'm not going to put you on the spot by telling you what – I'll just tell you what he told me you said, and I want you to tell me if it's fact or fiction, but just say it's fact because it's such a great story. He said that you basically said, "Hey, Big George, you see all these people in the stands? All of them are still going to read about it in the paper in the morning because they're going to love what they're about to see." And then you went out and hit the shot. True or false?
Similar to that.
Yes!
And think about George Faber. A guy named Thompson, you heard of that guy. He played in the ABA.
Yep.
He was on Marquette, too. Now he's got it on the wing with 25 seconds to go in the overtime. And
George Thompson, by the way, yep.
George Thompson, yeah. And Faber's guarding him. Faber gets on his knees and steals the ball from him with about 14 seconds to go. So we got it, timeout, just like you said. And George says, "Well, we're gonna run it down to about 8 seconds, and Mount's going to get the ball, and he's going to shoot it. And if he misses overtime, if he hits it, we're in the final four." And then I said something to George about what you just – that story he told you.
Beautiful.
And so we let it go down to about six. And in George's custom ways, I'm not going to say what he said, but the head coaches told me this, that damn it, they waited too long, like that. And I get the ball. Jerry Johnson sets a little pick over there, and I get off on it, and about 23-footer, and get nothing but that, and we're in the Final Four.
Rick, you know, when you grow up in Indiana, Rick Mount is our guest. When you grow up in Indiana, there are, I think before you learn to ride a bike in this state, before you learn your ABCs, you learn two facts. The first is that Rick Mount was on the cover of Sports Illustrated in high school. Only a female swimmer had done that before as a high school athlete. And the other is that Rick Mount once, in a pregame, could tell that the rim was cocked and went up to the officials in Iowa and said, look, the rim's bent. And they got out a ladder and a ruler, and they said, I'll be damned, he's right. How in the world could you tell that a rim was bent? And take me through that story.
Yeah, well, I've shot on so many rims. But it happened in the Final Four. We go in on Wednesday for a shoot around at Freedom Hall.
Yeah, it happened twice, right?
Yeah, and we go in there, and they just put the rims up. And I told George, I said, that one rim down to that north end down there is down in the, on the right-hand side. You better tell that guy that. And he goes down and tells that guy, the guy, I said, and he comes back over there, and he says, kiss his ass. I said, well, then kiss his ass, get his level out, and put the level on there, and it was off. So he got it straightened out, that guy, the maintenance guy. And that's how that story was. But you've shot, you know, I shot so many shots and millions of shots, maybe millions, that I, every time I'd look, I could tell if it was even or what.
You guys blow away, you know, obviously Carolina in the Final Four. You get into the national championship game against UCLA. And I'm curious for you, Rick Mount, you know, in the years since then, how often you think about, because I know Purdue fans do, you know, The reality is your teammate Chuck Babis is hurt. I mean, he's your center, right? He's unavailable. Gilliam's hurt. Billy Keller's dinged up. How much do you lose sleep still to this day occasionally over what could have been if you'd been healthy?
Well, you know, go back to that North Carolina game with Dean Smith. You know, they come out of the ACC all hepped up and Charlie Scott, you know, they got Charlie Scott, a couple 7-footers and things. But in an article when we were down there, they were interviewing Gene, the coach, the North Carolina coach. And he never mentioned Purdue's name in this article. All he could talk about is how he was going to hold Lou Alcindor and what they were going to do against Lou Alcindor and all this bull crap, you know. And that, you know how that goes, because, you know, Keller and Game and Davis and myself, we were pretty competitive. So we come out and beat them 92-67. So that got us into the final game, and we were dinged up. Bavis got hurt in the Mideast Regional. He tore something in his chest and cartilage or whatever it was. And Gilliam had a bad leg, and Keller had some problems, and I had a few problems. So we won at full strength, and we played them out there in California. The first game of the season, they beat us 5 points out there at Pauley Pavilion. And, you know, they beat us 1 point at Purdue. So this would be the third time we'd played them. And the bad thing about it, Jerry Johnson, he was about 6'9", weighed about 165, 175. There's no way he was going to hold Lou Alcindor away from that basket. Now, Bavis could. You know, they always talked about Bavis. And Bavis, he kind of got the short end of the deal with us, because we, you know, with Gilliam and Keller and myself, we were perimeter offensive team, you know. And Bavis, he scored 12 and 10, but he got kind of shortchanged a little bit. But he would have got a chance to play in the NBA, I think. So we had four guys that were pro players. So, you know, anytime, and I think this team right now, Smith said it pretty well last week, we are on a mission. And I loved when he said that because we were on a mission too. We didn't talk trash. We didn't make fun of people. When we got between those lines and laced them up, we were going to beat your ass. That's what it was all about. And so, but Big Lou was in the way, and we were runner up. And I, Jake, I tell you, nobody remembers who was runner up. You got to win it, and that's what I'm saying about Purdue. If they don't win it, and if they get beaten in the championship game, they're always saying Connecticut, Connecticut, Connecticut. They won't mention Purdue's name unless you're in Mackey Arena or something like that, watching a game. So it was fun, and we went a long way, and we just didn't get it done all the way.
Rick, I know it's, you know, obviously it's kind of apples and oranges because of so many factors, games played, years played. I mean, obviously you couldn't play as a freshman back in those days, but the reality is that Zach Edey is now statistically the leading scorer in Purdue history. His journey has been fascinating to watch. Just what is your overall reaction in seeing your record eclipsed and watching Zach Edey represent Purdue?
Well, not, you know, I don't hold against Zach Edey. He set... Here's the way I feel about it, and I don't want to sound sour grapes, but apples to oranges, yeah, but apples to apples, no. I played 72 games and had 23-23, and I think he went by me at, what, 140 games. And I don't hold that against him. He set his own – what I feel, he's in my mind, he set his own record of 140 games. He's the leading scorer. I'm not going to – you know, the guy's a great player, a college player. And so, great. I had it for 54 years. So, and the thing is, nothing against the players that played there, but – a lot of those players had a 140-game career. And I can't believe it wasn't broken before then, you know. I'm not knocking anybody, but it's but I don't know. It was great, and they're on a roll. And I'll tell you one thing. I don't know if anybody can get 61, though. That's a lot of points.
And I'll tell you what, double figures for 72 consecutive games, 46 games with 30 or more for Rick Mount. Obviously a prolific career. I'm curious of this. I know you still put up shots. I know you still teach kids how to shoot the basketball. You still try to get the right fundamentals for shooters. When Rick Mount watches basketball in 2024 and looks back on since when you were playing to now, the best shooter Rick Mount has seen is who?
Me?
Yes! Yes!
I don't see anybody better than me. I am being cocky because I could do it. But, gosh, I don't know. It's kind of... I had to think on that a while.
Well, here's the thing. A lot of people have to think on that a while, right? If you tell people the best shooter not named Rick Mount, they're like, I don't know, I got to think about it. Steph Curry probably comes to mind because of the quick release, but just in terms of pure fundamental, right?
Yeah, I'm jumping up over people and stuff like that. You know, but, you know, some people say, well, who do you think was the best shooter ever? Now, well, Jimmy Rail's going to say me. It's Jimmy Rail. Alfred's going to say him, and I'm going to say me. But I said that's why they make McDonald's and small – little pubs and bars and barber shops and stuff, so everybody can go in and argue who was the best shooter to ever live. And that kind of so, but it was fun, and Purdue was a great place. And what I love about Purdue is their fans. They had great fans, and. And we had, you know, we got beat by Iowa in the Big Ten my senior year. And I'd have to look it up. But we only lost three games in that place in 3 years, and we had a, like a 33-game winning streak till Iowa beat us 1 point at the end of my senior year. That's pretty good. And I had really good players with me, though. You got to remember that.
Rick, lastly, what's your plan for the game? I mean, are you going to be going out to Phoenix, or do you just you going to just stay around so you can go to the barbershop and talk about it the day after for the Final Four? Rick Mount's Purdue plans on watching the Boilers is what?
Well, I'm going to get me an iced tea. I'm going to come in my office here, and I'm going to watch the game, sit in my easy chair.
That is good living right there, right?
Well, I don't have to mess with anybody, you know, and people ask me, what do you think and stuff. I'm just sitting here and cuss a little bit and yell a little bit.
Absolutely beautiful. Rick, I'll tell you what, man, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. You know, one of the great things about teams making runs is it allows us to then talk about other great players and great moments in the school's history, and you absolutely are a pillar amongst that and with Indiana basketball as well.
Appreciate it, Jake.
Appreciate it very much. Rick Mount, the Rocket, and, of course, Mr. Basketball, the pride of Lebanon. Still, you see it if you're driving on 65. The name right there, Rick Mount for Lebanon, Indiana.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
To 7 seconds.
You can see the time. Wittenberg. Oh, that's a long ways.
They won it. On the dunk.
That was how it sounded when Derek Wittenberg hoisted up kind of a prayer that Lorenzo Charles ended up dunking and allowing Jim Valvano to run around. We anticipate Derek Wittenberg joining us here in just a minute. Again, he is now the athletic director for community relations and student support at North Carolina State University. And maybe he's got called into a meeting. Jimmy, it happens, right?
Yeah, it does. And I will say, I mentioned this earlier in the show, but if you've not seen it, or if you're just looking for something to, I guess maybe if you're not if you're a Purdue fan, because you're not trying to rep the Wolfpack this weekend, I get it. But if you're looking for something to fill the time over the day and a half between when the national semifinal occurs, go on ESPN Plus or go on, you know, wherever, YouTube, and find it. The 30 for 30 documentary came out about 11 years ago now, Survive in Advance, which tells the story of that 1983 championship team. It tells about Derek Wittenberg, Lorenzo Charles, the two of them completely intertwined and connected with one another forever. He acknowledges that. In fact, it's in the first scene of the documentary when he's at Lorenzo Charles' funeral and he's speaking on, you know, behalf of that connection they've had. Moments in sports, moments in life, there are certain things that will, Jake, indelibly unite you and connect you for all time. And that specific play, even when they've both passed, I know it's Charles that has passed and Wittenberg is still alive and well, but long when we're all gone, when you're still talking about college basketball in some capacity or sports in some capacity, that is one of the most iconic moments in the history of the tournament. And that is a moment of, you know, whether it was a pass or a three-pointer, I know they've joked about it in the years since, but that play itself of the long three by Wittenberg and then Charles slamming it home to knock out Sly Famajama. I mean, it was incredible, right?
Do you in any way, shape, or form worry that they are again like a team of destiny? Because didn't you kind of expect like the bubble to burst by now for North Carolina State?
Yes, multiple times.
And is it possible they just figured something out just in terms of the way that they're operating offensively?
Look, they definitely have offensively, but even more so defensively. And look, I Purdue's region, as things played out, and I know that they wouldn't have faced NC State in their region based on the selection committee, the way things went, but I felt like Purdue could get out. I did pick ultimately in my bracket, which doesn't matter. It's been dead forever, right? But I picked Tennessee in that Elite Eight matchup. Thought that maybe Dalton Connect would be a little bit too much for them. But here they are now. and you look at potential matchups, and Purdue fans, I'm sure we're doing this throughout the tournament, but oh, who's going to come out of the other side? Who are you going to meet in the semifinal? I thought they matched up pretty well with Duke. Filipowski didn't do anything for me in terms of what he could have or could not have done to Zach Edey, but the Blue Devils did have some solid guards, and one thing that NC State has done, not just the entire tournament, but specifically against Duke, when it's a trip to the Final Four on the line against one of the most prestigious programs in the sport, they limited them from beyond the arc. They limited them from the field. Like, they had a bad offensive day, did the Duke Blue Devils, and we just saw, even though it didn't matter because Zach Edey's inhuman, we just saw a tough play or a tough stretch of shooting from Purdue against Tennessee, and it didn't matter because Zach Edey was enough. If NC State's able to force another off night, and I don't think they will. Again, I'm picking Purdue. I think Purdue's going to cover and win comfortably. But if NC State is able to hang around and have another off shooting night forced by their opponent, in this case Purdue, it all turns to that Zach Edey-DJ Burns matchup. And is he enough, even though he's still undersized by height, but sized enough in terms of strength and size? Does that become the true signature matchup of this game, and it all comes down to which big man outplays the other?
Yeah, I mean, that's... I do think it's hard to think that they're going to be able to contend with Edey, right? Because I don't know, and you tell me if you disagree, but like, it doesn't feel like Carolina State's bigs have, you know, exceptional mobility, right?
Eddie pointed this out to me yesterday, and I'm not trying, I know we're trying to still get Derek Wittenberg, but I'll paraphrase what Eddie mentioned. DJ Burns has not played the type of minutes per game that Zach Edey has. He's right around 29, 30 a game. So even if Burns isn't in foul trouble, and he is by far their de facto big man, he has captivated the country. That type of situation with his size and his stamina and where he's been in short bursts has been the key to NC State's run. That has been the aspect of just unguardability that you've seen at times when Zach Edey's been in the post that's been there for DJ Burns. And if he's, Eddie, even able to be out of the game, not for fouls, but for rest at any point in time, that's a win for Purdue because I don't see anywhere else that they can hope to neutralize Edey.
100% agree with you there. And you look at DJ Burns, 6'9", 275, in the minutes that he's played so far in the NCAA tournament, like I mentioned to you yesterday after the show, 16-42 in that overtime game against Oakland, 27 against Marquette, and then 29 against Duke.
Yeah, to bring you in, you know, with that, Jake, if Burns is out, whether it's fouls or whether it's rest, those are the areas where Purdue has to maximize the offense, especially down low to Edey, because Burns is really the only hope they have to minimize him in any way, just because of what he brings to the table.
You know, the part of me just thinks you got to just, maybe the game plan is you just let Edey get his 40. If that makes sense.
I've thought that for most of the season. Yeah.
Joining us now on the program, as we talked about, he was one of the heroes of the 1983 North Carolina State Cinderella run that is being matched now, perhaps by this team. Derek Wittenberg joins us on the program. And Derek, I appreciate the time. I'll get right to it by asking this. Do you feel like you're living the dream all over again? This feels externally very similar to your guys' 83 run. Does it feel the same now when you're watching it this close?
Oh, absolutely, guy. How ironic you guys calling me on the anniversary of our championship, April 4th, when we won it 41 years ago. And we're talking about the team in 24, and they're incredible one. Listen, if we don't win the ACC tournament 41 years ago, three games, we're not in the tournament. This team had to win five games in a row in ACC tournament to get there, and it's an incredible run. Now they're nine games in a row. Unbelievable. And never thought in my lifetime I'd see it, but I'm enjoying it, man. I love the ride. You know, being back up at alma mater as an associate athletic director and ambassador, it's been great, man. I've enjoyed the run.
What are your thoughts on Purdue?
You know, I think they're more than just Edey. You know, I think that they got a solid team. You don't get to the Final Four without having a solid team.
So obviously they got a great player in Edie in there. It's hard to handle, but I think that their guard play, the other players in their system, I think they're good. They're a solid team, and our philosophy is this: you know, one player can't beat you. Let's worry about the other guys, because the other guys are very dangerous and capable as well.
Derek, I know it's not a perfect one-for-one comparison because you had to face this man multiple times in conference and then in the ACC tournament and then again in the regional final. But is there something poetic and has you pinching yourself for the fact that this NC State team also has to go through, in all likelihood, a back-to-back National Player of the Year in the same way you guys did, a three-time National Player of the Year in Ralph Sampson?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just a lot of similarities. But what I like about this team is that nobody thought they would be there. I'm not even sure they thought they was going to be there. But that's the beauty of sports and all these analysts. You hear these guys making all these predictions. That's one thing in sports you cannot do. You got to wait and see what happens, because nobody gave this team a chance. And kudos to Coach Keats and his staff and these kids. They persevered, man, and nobody gave them a chance. And they hear, you know, and once you get to the Final Four, as you remember when we did it, anybody can win at any big game.
Derek, when I think back, Derek Wittenberg is our guest from North Carolina State. Of course, the Wolfpack taking on Purdue in the Final Four. Going back to your 83 team, and I know a lot has been said about this, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to let our listeners know, in the fact that it almost seems in hindsight, sometimes in hindsight you look back at stories and you go, it ended the way it was supposed to end. And with what ultimately, you know, we learned about the spirit, and you guys knew it, but we didn't, right? The spirit and the energy of Jim Valvano, the camaraderie of your group, and just all of it, and the bond that you guys probably still have, and then, of course, you know, the passing of Lorenzo Charles. What did that group mean to you guys, and how much was brotherhood and leadership of Jim Valvano as much a part of it as the X's and O's of hitting shots?
Well, that's the key. It's the connection from the coach to the players is imperative. And some coaches have it and some coaches don't. And Jim Valvano was a man of personality. He really cared about his players. And he also trusted his players, and we in turn trusted him. You know, so the brotherhood we built throughout the, not just after the during the championship, but after the championship, how we've connected and stayed together and experienced. It's one thing in sports, you experience something like this, it's once in a lifetime experience that people will remember for the rest of your life. I mean, I never thought we'd see this again, and now the 24 team is doing their thing. But people are still talking about the 1983 championship, which is incredible. And now these kids are part of history. They're part of NC State athletic history. They're part of North Carolina history. They're part of college basketball history, and they're part of the ACC history. So this is something that nobody can take away from them, and it's going to stay with them for the rest of their lives.
NC State legend Derek Wittenberg is our guest, member of the 1983 national champion Wolfpack team. Derek, you also executive produced one of my favorite 30 for 30, Survive in Advance. 11 years ago is when that documentary released, and you talk about the togetherness of that team. It's a very powerful 30 for 30 across the board, and right out of the gate it hits you with you speaking at the funeral of your friend and teammate Lorenzo Charles, and you telling the rest of your Wolfpack teammates, or you guys getting together and saying, hey, if we don't get together and see each other at least once a year, we're only going to be doing it at events like this. Does the pack still get together every year? I know it's documented well that you did during the documentary, but has that still been a tradition the last 10 years, you guys getting together?
Oh, absolutely. And we're going as far as that. Now we got a group text. The guys constantly talk every day. Now, I'm not an everyday talker, but our guys are communicating every day. That's the beauty and the power of social media and technology, that now we can basically connect every day. But we're still getting together. We just celebrated last year our 40th anniversary of our championship. So we make a point to get together every year, at least once, to see each other, to pay homage. And because, you know, this is once lifetime run. And, you know, you got to cherish that. And it's a lifelong bond that we've created with each other, and a lot of respect and honor. That's what you learn about being a part of great teams, and we certainly are humbled and honored to be a part of it.
Derek, since it was 41 years ago today, and since many like myself had a bedtime and couldn't stay up late since it was in the Mountain Time Zone in Albuquerque, Gary Bender was on the call for CBS television. The clock's running down. You guys are moving the ball around the perimeter. You know you need to get a shot. Here's what I want to do for you, Derek Wittenberg. I'm going to play for you. You've only heard it 15,000 times. But I'm going to play for you that last 15 seconds. I want you to listen to it and then tell us what immediately floods back, not only of your memories in the moment, but your memories now of hearing this yet once again. Go ahead.
It's down to 7 seconds. You can see the time. Wittenberg. Oh, it's a long ways.
They won it. On the dunk.
Right before that, the ball was nearly stolen. That pushed you back to about 35 feet where you had to hoist that shot. Your reaction just in hearing that once again and feeling that moment again?
Well, one thing about basketball, it's a reaction game, not a thinking game. So with 7 seconds left, when you see that ball, you have a clock in your head. It's time and score. We learned that. And I know that I had to get it up there. So to make it clear to everybody, even 41 years ago, that was a pass.
That was a heck of a pass.
It was a heck of a pass. You know, I got a book coming out in 2 or 3 weeks called The Shot Heard Around the World, How I Went from the Playground in the White House. And I illustrate that whole journey in terms of my eyes and how it looks from my perspective. And it's going to be different than a documentary, but it's going to be a more story about my Wittenberg game and my family and all the people that helped me along the way. And some great stories, some great photographs in the book. It's going to be hot. And I just enjoyed, I talked earlier about the total experience of a college athlete. You get the opportunity. I'm a first-generation graduate. I was the first in my family to get a college scholarship. I was the first to get a scholarship and go to a school at that magnitude, at that level. I came out a better person, and they end up winning the national championship. You know, what more can you ask for in one experience? So I got the total college experience at NC State. That's why I'm back here, to see kids like this. Our women's basketball team going to the Final Four. You know, we won 3 national championships in cross country, won the swimming championship. I mean, we got so many great things going on at NC State. This is just the icing the cake what these 2 basketball programs are doing. But I want to tell the story about why college is still a great experience, the total experience for an athlete. It's not just about transfer portal. It's not just about NIL. It's a total experience of getting a great education, meeting great people, lifelong relationships, and maybe one day you get the chance to put that banner up.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Now, Derek, tell me the name of the book that's coming out again.
It's called The Shot Heard Around the World, How I Went from the Playground to the White House.
Now, shouldn't that be called The Assist Heard Around the World?
Well,
who's your editor?
You got to read the book to get more knowledge on it. Okay,
all right,
you
got fair enough. Fair enough. I like that. Hey, before we let you go, 2 other things I want to ask. Number one, you know, Benny Anders is the guy that deflected the pass that was going to you that caused you to have to, we'll say, give the assist to Charles from so far out. Do you have any relationship with those Houston guys, or do you ever, you know, good natured ribbing about what could have been?
Oh, absolutely. When we did the documentary, we called up Elijah Wan, and he was great. He was great. He was on the film. He was outstanding. And Now, Clyde is still kind of hurt a little bit, you know, because Terry Gannon tackled him at the end of the game, and it should have been a foul on Terry, but he still remembers Terry Gannon about that tackle at the end of the game. But I told Clyde and Elijah, when I said, listen, guys, y'all let us – we won this championship, okay, and then it inspired you guys to go to Houston and win two world championships. So that actually helped you guys. They didn't kind of understand that, but that's what I had to tell them. I said it really helped you. But now those guys really, they've been great. They really have been great, and I've talked to Clyde several times, and he's a good sport about it.
Derek, we did not get Derek Wittenberg of North Carolina State is our guest. We have not gotten the chance, I guess, for as long a period of time to get to know Lorenzo Charles because he was tragically killed in a bus crash, you know, 13 years ago. So I wanted to give you the opportunity. What can you tell us about him as a man and teammate?
Wonderful kid. A lot, not as boisterous as DJ Burns, but kind of a quiet personality. Loved people, had a big smile. Had loads of potential as a player, and just blossomed at the right time. He's a sophomore, but he was really coming on. And, you know, the next year, the following year, when he's a junior, he really stepped it up. But tragic loss for us. But, you know, we remember him every day. My life is always going to be connected with Lorenzo Charles. As long as I'm on this earth, that Lorenzo Charles, that last play, everybody remember that. Every day of my life since it's happened, somebody's talked about that play with myself and Lorenzo Charles.
I guess sometimes in life when you've got to make a desperate pass, you got to have a friend to be able to turn it into a great moment, right? That's kind of what you learn from that.
Absolutely. Hey, guys, when I do my book signing in Indianapolis, I want you guys to be there. It's going to be great. I got some neat photographs. I got some great stuff in this book. I tell some unbelievable stories about life and basketball and leadership and teamwork. It's going to be an incredible book, guys.
Now, Derek, we look forward to it. We'll take you up on it. We'll stay in contact. I'll leave you with this. I was in the pit in Albuquerque. I told this story on the air, but about 5 years ago, a buddy of mine and I were going to be in Albuquerque, and I said, I got to go to the pit and see where the moment was, right? So we go out there, and a guy from New Mexico basketball brings out a ball, and I reenacted the shot. And I got to tell you, I was so proud of myself, and I think I called you out on like Facebook Live because I actually hit the shot. And then I realized, Derek, that the shot that I was taking with one person there filming me on Facebook and the shot that you were taking were two totally different atmospheres. So advantage you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you got the better end of it there, right? It's easy to hit when there's nobody in the gym is what I'm getting at. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a lot of people running around. You know, was running around during that time talking about Wittenberg for three, you know, making some three-point shots. So, listen, don't remember me always as the guy that made the pass. Remember, I was the top scorer in the history of the tournament that year. I was in the top five in scoring. So, like, I did make a few baskets, too, now.
And you did have the most important assist in the history of the tournament. All right, lastly, Derek, for North Carolina State to beat Purdue, they're going to have to do what?
Guard play. I think DJ Burns and Big Edie that could equally wash itself out. Both of them got the ability to score inside, but at the end of the day, guys, it's going to be guard play. I think Purdue's point guard is really underrated. I think he's pretty good, and when Big Edie comes up to that screen, well, we can handle that and keep that kid from knocking. But I think their other team is solid. It's sort of almost like people are not paying attention to Purdue. I think they're better than what people think. And we're this team that's we got nothing to lose, and everybody's expecting them to win. But I feel a little hunger about Purdue, too, because, like, this is their last chance. And I watched Edie's interview talking about how people passed him up and didn't think he was real good. So he's got a little fire in his eyes. And then, we got a lot of confidence. So it's going to be an interesting game. I think it's a good matchup for us. And if DJ Horn can get going, we got to make some shots from the outside. It's going to be hard to get second shots with the big fella down there. So we're going to have to be hot from the outside.
Derek, it's been a pleasure. Appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you when you come to Indy and helping you out with the book. And in the meantime, enjoy celebrating 41 years of the anniversary of a national championship and the pass heard around the world.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Derek Wittenberg of North Carolina State University.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Pacers fall in Brooklyn last night.
Thank you. Well done.
115-111, the
Such
final.
Such a suck-up.
The Nets get the job done, and unfortunately, it also knocks the Pacers out of the sixth spot if the season ended today based on win percentage. Miami Heat now overtake them on the sixth seed. Pacers being a part of the play-in if things ended today. He covered the action last night. Joining us now, one of our favorites. We talk to him weekly. He's Tony East. You can find his work on Sports Illustrated, Forbes as well, and of course on the Locked On Pacers podcast. Tony, always good to catch up with you. And as we dive right into things, when you look back at last night's loss to the Nets, how much of it can we read into of, man, shorthanded without Miles Turner, his presence was missed last night?
That's a factor for sure. I mean, the game they played Monday, they were up 29 in the first half when Turner was playing, and he was cleaning up a lot of their mistakes, right? They were giving up drive after drive to the Nets in that first half, and he had five blocks and made a bunch of great plays. But they didn't have him last night in the second quarter. Nets were making drive after drive, and there was no one to bail them out at all. They were scoring at the rim. They were spraying it to the right shooters. Noah Clowney got hot. Cam Thomas got going. Dennis Schroeder got going. And they needed him. They didn't even play that well in the second half Monday without him after he hurt the finger. But he is saving them from problems that are happening elsewhere, right? The problem wasn't necessarily that he wasn't playing, although he would have helped. They were just getting destroyed by drives over and over. Straight line drives right to the basket. We're beating guys all night last night. And especially in that second quarter when they gave up 42 and gave away their 14-point lead in, you know, half of a quarter, it was killing them. They couldn't stop anybody, and they weren't getting the same level of help around the basket as they were 2 days earlier. It really hurt them. I don't know how much he could have helped them offensively with two fingers stuck together, but his defensive presence alone would have helped in a way, and they needed him last night. They didn't have him.
Tony, I was mentioning this earlier. To me, the thing, kind of the last step, I guess, for the Pacers, this Pacers group, like if we knew last year this was like a three-year rebuild, right? And maybe it's been accelerated by the emergence of Halliburton, the acquisition of Siakam. So maybe from a roster standpoint, it's pretty close to what we're going to see here for a couple of years. But my observation, and I want you to add to this or disagree if you'd like, is kind of the last piece for them is just to learn consistency. And one of the real challenges of the NBA is winning every game as opposed to just elevating in the games that are going to be a challenge for you. And this team has yet to master that. Your thoughts?
I agree. And I think that kind of comes with the makeup of their team, right? What I mean by that is, you know, top two offense this season in the league, but a bottom, I think, six now defense. You know, that opens you up to a lot of inconsistent results, whether that's, you know, this week, I mean, smoking the Lakers last week, beating the Nets handily and then losing to the Nets, whether that's their Bulls loss, their Hornets. I mean, we've all known they're terrible losses all season. Like, other teams can just have good nights against them, and then their margin for error is way smaller. And that's my running theory of why they're so inconsistent this season, because all the other teams that have so many losses that their fan base would consider unacceptable, right? The Kings, who lost to the Hornets and Wizards and Blazers all at home, and the Mavs have a bunch of crummy losses. The Hawks are terrible against under 500 teams. They all are the same way. They all have really good offenses and really bad defenses. And so it opens you up to a bad offensive night or a decent offensive night from another team. You can lose. Your consistency is not there, where as defense travels a little better, and it's why a team like the Magic, who are amazing on defense but not so good on offense, really clean up against crummy teams, right? They're not so good against the top teams. They don't have as high of a ceiling, but their floor is really high. So, to put it simply, I agree with you 100%. Their consistency is all over the place. And I think the biggest reason for that is because their defense comes and goes. And there are nights like last night where even for just 15 minutes, their defense is awful and it's worse than the league level and it costs them a game they should win. They can't have that, but it's what their team is right now.
Pacers beat writer for SI, Tony East, with us. Tony, I feel like you were, of all that cover the team, probably the most level-headed in terms of the struggles that Tyrese Halliburton had, over the last month or so. He has another, at least in terms of on paper, solid night last night. I mean, he's only 35% from three, but still he's knocking in five of them instead of a 1-for-8 performance that we've grown, unfortunately, accustomed to throughout March. He dishes it well and finishes with 24, and that's kind of stacking good performances from him from beyond the arc. From your evaluation of that run, of what we remember, or the struggles of that run in March, to where he's at now, is he somewhere in the middle from where he was at the start of the year? Is he just getting more comfortable, as Jake has pointed out a couple times, with Pascal Siakam and the offense ramping back up to where it was? What would you point to Tyrese Halliburton rediscovering his shot here in the stretch run?
Yeah, I think, you know, figuring things out with Pascal certainly helps. Like, it's not lost on me. Halliburton wasn't even shooting, but when they made their big comeback last night in the fourth to actually regain the lead, they went to just Halliburton Siakam two-man game like four times in a row. Like, that just works and can generate a good shot for them. I think a little bit is finding his joy and confidence again, right? He had that game in Detroit where he played very well, and he only took three threes that night. He made one of them, but he just found other ways to be effective and realized that, you know, that there are other things he can do. He's still playing well. He just needs to find a way to settle in for the shot. And, you know, once you have just one game of seeing it, or once you rediscover your kind of purpose as the shooter, it can all come back. And he had that game against Golden State where that happened, and you've kind of seen it flow ever since. It hasn't been as good as it was early in the season, of course. You know, there's still some games where he doesn't take the insane one-legged ones that he was, you know, drilling for the entire month of November, it felt like. But certainly some growth there in terms of how he's fitting with the new look of the team, his health, his confidence, his joy for the game. You've seen dunks in each of the last three games from him, which I think that I can't remember him dunking three games in a row covering him before. So a lot going better for him. The Pacers just needed to lead to consistent wins, because every game is critical for them now.
Where would you assess Jalen Smith's performance in the rare instances this year, and it's most notable last night, where he is called up into the starting role when Miles is not available?
Yeah, there's two factors of that. Like, oh, when Miles isn't available specifically, they're 2-3 in those five games Miles hasn't played this season. And it's just way different, right? What he can provide versus what Miles Turner provides is way different. I believe this was the first time that he started with Siakam this season. I might have one of those wrong. But, you know, when he was starting at the four, like, you saw how that helped the team, and what his role was made a lot of sense. And when he's with the second unit, he has been really helpful. But just what Miles Turner gives the starters versus what Jalen Smith can do just isn't the same, right? Even if Smith has become more comfortable at the five this year, and last night he had a couple threes that were just, you know, not what the team needed at the time, and they didn't go in. Obviously, that's a big factor here, but he hasn't been as effective in that role, and there could be a number of reasons for that, but they just don't have the same skill set, particularly on the defensive end, and his rebounding is valuable, but you have to force misses to get boards and all sorts of stuff like that. It just, 2-3 speaks for itself, but it hasn't been the same this year as it has been in other seasons for him as a starter. He's been better as a four as a starter and five with the second unit. So when Turner's out, it's a big loss.
Tony, I'm going to rinse and repeat. Tony East is our guest talking about the Pacers. I'm going to rinse and repeat a topic that we have talked about over the last couple of years, seemingly, and especially this time of year. I think it was 2 years ago. But as his number gets called upon and Jalen Smith continues to play, whether it be in a fill-in role when Miles Turner's hurt or is a, you know, complimentary role, whatever it might be, is he starting to potentially show and price himself beyond what Indiana is going to be able to do to retain him as part of their long-term vision?
Oh, yeah, especially as we get later into the season. You know, it's been interesting because post-trade deadline, the three hasn't really been there for him the way it was early in the season when he couldn't miss. And I don't want to ascribe, like, he was hurt for a while with that back injury, so I don't want to, it could be a slump, it could be injury-related, who knows. But especially last night, like, if just one of those went in that he took, you know, that they probably win. So, you know, the shooting hasn't been there as much. So the question with him becomes, what does he want, right? And what is the value of a backup center in the NBA? He does have age on his side, so I think lots of teams would be willing to figure out what that is. But can he find a starting role somewhere else, or can he find an opportunity with more minutes because Miles Turner's still going to be, you know, around next year for the Pacers? I think those are maybe bigger factors than the money for him with that player option, because especially around the season, he was playing great. He was totally worth more than his money. But backup center is, you know, there's plenty of them around the league. Some of them aren't even in the league. Cody Zeller not on a team for almost all last season, for example. Isaiah Jackson's still on the Pacers, so it'll be interesting to see what his kind of summer looks like. I think it might depend more on his goals than the Pacers' goals, but I mean, we saw early in the season how important he can be when he's playing at his absolute best. So I mean, the playoffs could be a factor too. If he has a great postseason, that could change what he thinks about his future, what the Pacers need to defend. It's all still in the air to me.
Tony, what winds up being the ultimate role come postseason, play in or play off, for Doug McDermott? Because it feels like the minutes fluctuation is at some point either lineups or matchup based, depending on the opponent, when he gets the increased role. And there's other times where it's just a sparing 5-6 minutes a night. I know when the trade happened, it was just a veteran shooter potentially to add in to lessen the blow of losing a, you know, an in the league great shooter in Buddy Hield. What winds up being his postseason role when that time arrives here in the next week or so?
I think we've gotten hints in the last week or so that it won't exist, that his role might be nothing from that time. Last night against the Nets, he played in the first half for 6 minutes. They lost those minutes by 4. That was in the midst of a really crummy stretch for the team. He did not play in the second half. They played the Lakers at home last Friday. He played for a minute and a half in the first half of that game, did not return all night. They played the Bulls right before that. Jairus Walker was ahead of him in the rotation. Now, Jairus did not have a good game, and they went back to McDermott in that game, and he got some garbage time minutes. But we've seen in 3 of the last 4 games, his role has been all over the place and not particularly big, you know. And since returning from that injury on March 20th, he's had 3 performances with under 6 minutes of play in the rotation, twice under 12 minutes. And those under 12-minute games were blowouts where he was in late. So his role is already the smallest. He's as the 12th man, and Jairus having that ascent on the road trip kind of tweaked things. But it seems like when these games get tighter, they get to a point where the Pacers say, you know, we've got something that's working with Ben Shepherd or Aaron Nesmith starting LeBron or whatever. They don't turn to him very much. So I think it could continue this way where maybe he plays like spot minutes in the first half. Maybe he makes a couple threes like he did against the Nets on Monday. But as the game progresses and they kind of figure out what's the best rotation for them on the wing or what do they need? Last night it was, you know, Ben Shepherd when Aaron Nesmith was in foul trouble. He doesn't play that much. So I think come playoff time when things really tighten and they, you know, the idea would be to play Aaron Nesmith 35 minutes a game, I the answer might be none at all. It might be like 2 or 3 minutes here or there, but it seems like it's trending towards a no role for him in the postseason.
Tony, Rick Carlisle recently passed, I believe, Red Auerbach, right, on the all-time wins list?
Correct.
For coaches?
Yes, on Monday. Yep.
Over the course of this year, how many different coaches has Rick Carlisle been? And by that, I mean, I don't mean that flippantly. I mean, has he, do you believe that Rick Carlisle began the year and said, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to play? Or has he himself had to adjust and reinvent styles over the course of the year?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what he's very good at, right? I think that when he got brought here was one of the things he, you know, was praised for, is that he gets a lot out of players and figures out the right role for them. And we've seen that as the season has progressed, right? Early in the season, he identified what Tyrese Haliburton could be and built a team that could play like him. And then they realized when they were 500 and around Christmas that they needed to tweak some things, find a way to play better defense, whether that's with lineup, whether that's with strategy. And that team was good until Haliburton got hurt. And then there was a trade and they had to figure out how to work Siakam in. And then there was another trade and they had to play Ben Shepherd more. And then Mathurin got hurt. Like he has had to continually adjust with what the team is. And they still have a top 2 offense in the league. Their defense has gotten better throughout the season. They've exceeded my expectations in terms of wins already. And I think that's one of his strengths as a coach. And I think you see that tactical side of him almost every game because they come out of halftime, they're one of the better teams in the league in those third quarters. Him and Haliburton are just really strong at reading a game and adjusting and figuring out how they can overcome whatever challenges the team is dealing with. And so in a lot of games, you see them come out of the second half and be, you know, a far superior team to their opponent. They're 7th in the league in third quarter net rating. This season, all the rest of the teams above them are very good teams. And so I think that's where he's shined. And just because of the dynamics of the season with injuries, with trades, with a young team being better than a lot of people thought, he's kind of had to tweak who they are every couple weeks. And I think for better or worse, that's worked out for them and given them more looks they can go to if they need to make adjustments in the playoffs. But they got to get there first. That's his challenge for the last 5.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Tony East is our guest, covers the Pacers for Sports Illustrated, as well as you hear him on the Locked On Podcast Network for Locked On Pacers. Tony, I tweeted this last night. I didn't like dive into the archives for it, just did it off of memory. And I don't mean to fully skip across the matchup against the Thunder tomorrow night, because if the Pacers drop that, that puts them in further trouble. But for the sake of argument, let's say they win, and Gainbridge Fieldhouse likely rocking late Sunday afternoon, 5 o'clock tip time, I believe, when they welcome in the Miami Heat into town. Biggest regular season game, I said, since the Oladipo era. Would you argue with that?
No, definitely I would not argue with that. I mean, last year they got eliminated with like 10 days to go. And I guess, Jimmy, can I add an asterisk to that?
Absolutely.
Can I say non-in-season tournament regular season game?
Yeah, fair. Because those were fun. Those were electric. Okay, that's a good point.
I forgot about those myself. But, I mean, they haven't been, you know, postseason bound since the Oladipo era. And they had those games in the bubble that were critical to them rising the standings before Sabonis had to leave, and they didn't even have a chance in that postseason. So, yeah, I think it's pretty easy to say that's their biggest regular season game in terms of what it could mean and impact since that era. All five of these last games are. I mean, really, there's a unique scenario where they don't quite, but they still kind of control their own destiny for the sixth seed because of that Miami game. But they got to win it. If they lose it, they lose that tiebreaker. They lose a lot of three-team tiebreakers. They obviously fall in the standings. Joel Embiid is back. Like, it is impossible to overstate how big that game is for the Pacers. Miami coming in on a 3rd-and-4 nights as well. Like, they have to take advantage of it. And I thought they would be up for the task, given how they'd played in their last 7 games going into last night. But then they fell flat on their face again. So it's hard to say what they really are at this point.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, as for the Thunder tomorrow night, Tony, they still very much have the one seed on the table. What do you envision from that matchup with so much at stake for both teams, albeit in different trajectories of their conference standings?
Yeah, the Thunder have not lost 3 games in a row all season, which is bad news for the Pacers because they enter today having lost 2 in a row. But their situation's unique. They're fighting for the one seed. Minnesota and Denver are playing very well right now in a game ahead of them. But Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's banged up. Jalen Williams is banged up. That's been hurting them recently as they go through this road trip. And I think this is their last game of a long road trip, which can be tiring for any team. Not to give the Pacers any sort of out. They need to win this game for whatever reason. They have one more road game after this Pacers game, excuse me. But they have not been playing their best. The Pacers did beat them with Shai available, but they're fighting like crazy. Every team the Pacers play, except for the Raptors, the rest of the season probably has some stakes. We'll see about the Hawks for the last game of the season. So they're not going to get into those easy end of season like the Thunder play, the Hornets on Sunday, for example. Easy ones where the team has nothing to play for. They're going to get some tough opponents with some tough punches, and the Thunder starts that tomorrow.
And you know Miami does too, right? Because that's the thing. After that Miami game, that game is only as big as how those two teams then close after it, right? And for Miami, they also have Atlanta in play right after that, I'm not mistaken. And Atlanta, that could determine, actually, Miami could turn around and then do the Pacers a favor, weirdly enough. Because if they eliminate Atlanta, then you got a totally different team you're finishing out with, right?
Yeah, the Hawks are 10th right now, and they can actually play for home court in that 9-10 game with the Bulls. So what the Pacers want is the Hawks to lose a bunch in the coming weeks and the Bulls to win a bunch, both because the Bulls play the Knicks 3 times still this season, which is crazy. And the Hawks could be playing for nothing on that last night of the season because the Heat's last 2 games are at home against the Raptors. If you haven't checked on the Raptors recently, I can't blame you. They've lost 15 games in a row. I don't think those are going to be difficult games for the Heat. So Pacers need to clean up that Heat game and hope Miami loses pretty much every other non-Hawks game they play this season, because here come the Sixers with Joel Embiid. The teams in front of them are playing decently well. I mean, it's all very convoluted and confusing. Big game tonight as the Heat play the Sixers in Miami. It's a huge one for the Pacers.
Pacers just want to avoid the Bulls, baby. Avoid the Bulls, Tony. That's the theme, right?
You know what's funny is, the way I think about the play-in and a best of one, I would want to play the team that I think has the least ability to go off with a hot shooting game. And in my head, that is the Bulls. They're not a good shooting team, so I feel pretty good about my chances if I play the Bulls. But they keep beating the Pacers.
I know.
Healthy amount. So maybe they don't want to play the Bulls.
DeMar DeRozan existing kind of puts water on that argument for me personally.
Pacers are like, bring on the Bucks in a 7 game. Let's go.
Like, in my head, I know he's not playing, so this is different. In my head, I'd rather play the Bulls than a Trae Young team in a play-in game just because Trae Young is capable of, you know, a crazy game. Where
lightning in a bottle guy, right?
Yeah, and the Bulls don't seem to have that, but the Pacers saw DeMar DeRozan have that game against them and can't beat them at all this year. They're 1-3 against them. So the theme we're getting to is, how about just avoid the play-in if you're the Pacers? Don't even deal with it.
Tony Pepper still clipping along?
I'm not seeing her today, but yeah, she's doing her thing. She's screaming in the middle of the night to wake me up, so she's making it work.
That's Tony's 28-year-old cat. Is that right?
The bit should be now that you say 1 year older every single week that I come on, and so it gets too unbelievable. Yeah, 21 or 22.
Okay, Tony, we appreciate the time as always.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate
Tony
it.
Tony East.